Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is the one, the only, Glenn Fleischman. Glenn, thank you for joining me.
It is such a pleasure to be back on this show.
You continue my string of repeat guests, so I'm excited to have you back. Tell the people, if they are unfamiliar with you, which I find hard to believe, a little bit about yourself.
I am a veteran technology journalist, grizzled. I've shaved recently, but I'm still grizzled. And I've written about Apple and other things for a long time. I like to write about really quirky historical technology things. And so recently I wrote a story about the history of this page left intentionally blank. And with the help of some manuscript scholars, we tracked it back to 1471, where you can find a page in a book. There they just ran out of stuff to say, and they said, in Latin, nothing is lacking. You're like, uh-oh. Sorry, we didn't have anything else for this page. But that's kind of what I do. So I write about technology, and I'm on a lot of podcasts, including on this Incomparable Network. And
yes.
I enjoy type and typography.
Well, who doesn't? What do you think about the typography in Star Trek: The Next Generation?
It's so perfect for its time. It's like you saw that thing that got spread around recently, the generator of like 1970s style TV graphics.
I did not see that.
Oh, it's amazing, and I'm blanking out on the name on it. And then somebody at I think it was Motherboard found the person who developed it. It was in some other country, and wrote a wonderful story about this guy and his wife and somebody else who works in the company. They'd done it almost as a joke. They didn't think people will get into it, but they really did it right. So you can punch stuff up and it makes like Miami Vice like logos. It's just absolutely, it's like every store
logo. I have seen that. The 80s style, right?
80, I'm sorry, you said 70s. I was, 80s style. Yeah. So it's not quite, you know, so Star Trek Next Generation is a little on the later, you know, it's towards the end of the 80s.
It is
so
late
it's
not, 80s, yeah.
Not quite as cheesy, but this thing was a remarkable blast in the past. But you can't see, the logo comes up for Star Trek Next Generation, and I'm taken back to my college days, and remember when it was so exciting to like have to watch TV when it was broadcast and gather around with friends and then try to catch reruns during the summer and see it. So it makes me feel young again to watch Next Generation.
I'm sure that somebody, and maybe even you, know the typeface name for the font that the Next Generation uses. I have no idea what it is, but it always it seems just so perfect, and that's probably just because I've seen it so many times with the title crawl. But I can't think of it without that typeface.
I'm totally ignorant of it. But, you know, actually I haven't seen a Next Generation episode, I would say, for a few years. I watched them, you know, when they first ran and then in reruns and then when it was more easy to watch them more recently, I've watched episodes here and there. And I had a friend who was, my friend Swoozy, who was on this podcast a couple years ago. She did a whole rewatch of, or she had never watched, rather. So she watched the entire Next Generation, and I watched an episode or two in sympathy with her at the time. And the type thing I forgot is the graphics in the show are so far ahead of their time that this, you know, there's things about it that are cheesy and dated and costuming and plot and whatever, but Next Generation, the visual displays are, they really do actually still look like they're from the future. And that is kind of like a 2001 Space Odyssey where they figured out how to, parts of it look really dated, that movie, but parts of it are, they feel like they understood what the future would look like in the future. And that is very difficult to do.
That's true. So that's the LCARS menu system does look like it is still the future of where we're going. And they and I don't know, and I always find this fascinating because I don't know how much of it is, clearly, you know, the set designers had a vision for what they wanted. But how much of that has then, because it's an interesting phenomenon, right? Because a lot of geeks obviously watch Star Trek and then they become the people who make the things that define the future. And so I wonder about how much influence Star Trek has had on, in fact, what gadgetry and interfaces look like, because, you know, Star Trek nerds are the ones that are putting this stuff and they want to have the Enterprise bridge. So we're talking about The Next Generation because we watched a Next Generation episode. So the episode that we watched that people who are listening already know because it's in the title of the podcast is The Vengeance Factor, which is a season 3, episode 9, which features, of course, you can tell you're in season 3 because Riker has a beard. And this Riker is basically the main character.
Yes.
He's the man in this episode in many ways. And you know, he is the main character because there is a young lady, who is, well, spoiler alert, she's not that young. She appears to be
hot.
I know, it's crazy.
The convention of TV broadcasts, whether mm-hmm. they're drama or comedy, is that you have an A plot, mm-hmm. you have a B plot, sometimes mm-hmm. you have a C plot. I've seen shows that get away with D, E, F. Some sitcoms in 22 minutes, like Frasier, can layer in, like, there could be an H plot, right? Mm-hmm. And it all comes together at the end. This show, this episode had an A plot, basically. There was like an A and a half plot. There was no B plot. Really?
I don't even know what the half plot. I guess the figuring out, discovering her identity was, I guess, the half plot, but it's all A here.
It was kind of all, like, there was nothing else happening off to the side. It was all entirely main action that we sort of followed. It was practically, they could have shot at Cinema Verite or something.
They could have. And this episode, I mean, I'm going to jump to the end and say, not my favorite episode of Star Trek. a shocking, I know, to anyone who's actually seen this episode. I mean, it's not my least favorite episode of Star Trek ever, but it does have some super interesting things, like set wise. I think that the set for the gatherers like location features girders that they always have for these kinds of sets. I guess they just have them around that you can look at, watch like every other episode of TNG where they beam down to someplace that's invariably in a cave because that's where these people hang out and they've got girders. But the thing I really liked about that set is the lighting. It looks so cool. It almost made me think that I was in a different show because the lighting of that set was so different than everything else. And it starts off very green.
This one reminded me of the there was an episode where I've forgotten where it is. Maybe it was season 7 even, where there's a ancient Vulcan weapon that gets discovered. I've forgotten the episode, and I think Worf is involved with going down to a planet, and this turncoat Vulcan person who actually is angry, unlike other Vulcans, something like that. But there's a lot of girders. I remember girders and red lighting.
Yes.
It might have been the same set.
it probably was. But I like that set. And the beginning of this episode, also interesting set. It's, a research station that's been ransacked by these gatherers. And we've got, although I guess we don't know it at the time, it is interesting mostly because it's super green. And at one point it made me think, is my TV set incorrectly?
Yeah, I wasn't sure what's going on. It was actually, I think the teaser was very clever. I thought this, it really was set up to be a much more interesting episode than it turned out to be, or I should say more intriguing episode. Like you mm-hmm. think there's a bigger mystery. This looks like they're setting up one of those arcs and you don't know what's going to happen. It's like, no, they found it out in like 2 minutes.
Right, yeah, because there's the place has been ransacked. There's blood that isn't human. Dr. Crusher's like, I don't know what it is. I'll need to examine it. And they open a door. Although, you know, Worf tries to open the door, it's stuck, and then Data just opens it, which makes me think, why did Worf even try? But that's Data's a problematic character because he can do anything, really. And then behind that door, oh my God, unconscious scientists. It's a big mystery.
My favorite part here, though, is they're looking around and they know that like a nuclear reactor or some kind of reactor, fusion reactor, has been taken away. And Worf just starts picking stuff up and he flings it off screen in the direction of where other actors like Crusher have walked off. And you're like, that is surely a little bit foolhardy, security officer.
Well, you know, he's a Klingon. That's what they do. And so, yeah, that's – and you think, oh, they have to – this is a big mystery, right? Oh, who's done this? What's going on? But then we find out immediately who it is, and which is the – I guess I don't know how to say it. Akamarians,
I think. Like that's what I'm recollecting when she said.
Yes. And then we find out – you know, there's an intriguing thing where we find out, oh, no, they're basically space pirates that are causing trouble. And Captain Picard is like, okay, we have to get to the end of this, the finish of this, right? So let's go to the planet and talk to the president of the planet, I guess. I don't know. And make her agree to accept back the gatherers into the fold.
I know the Prime Directive doesn't apply because these are warp. I don't know if they're warp capable, but they're warp contact societies. But I thought they were trying to set up something about maybe it was going to be Roma. Like this would be like a metaphor mm-hmm. for people who had been, you know, these are people wandering. They've been put to the outskirts. So they are forced to scavenge because no one will take them in. And that didn't really play out either. There were some good moments, I thought, about that, but they didn't quite get the heart of that in there. There was never anything quite, racially tinged enough in the original series where you have the people who are black on one side and white on the other and white mm-hmm. or black like that. There was no message like that that came through. It was like, well, we had disagreements. They were slightly more bloodthirsty, so they left the planet screw them.
And we're happy they're gone. We're peaceful. We don't want anything to do with them. And Picard is like, well, listen, They're causing the Federation trouble. So you have to take them back, whether you like it or not. And she is like, okay, you've completely convinced me in like 2 seconds that this fundamental belief of our society is wrong and we should once again accept these people back into our civilization, which is a very Star Trek-y thing.
Yeah, I didn't feel like we had any sense of like if the Akamarians were part of the Federation, if Picard had any leverage, if it was just like strong urging. It was all a little confusing why they just listened to him, but they did. They just listened to him. She's like, all right, I guess we have to do this.
He sounds like he knows what he's talking about, I guess.
He's got a ship,
He has a ship. He knows how to use it.
I won't bring any security. I'll just bring like a few people, a few servants, and she head just off with no security or support of any kind. That'll
That's
be fine.
Right. My planet will be fine. Exactly. I've got two dudes and Yuta. That's all you need.
Two dudes and Yuta. It's a new sitcom.
That's right. And Yuta is probably next to the prime minister or whatever the heck she is, the president, whose name I don't even know because she's not really that important, is the important person, right? This is a story about Yuta and Riker, which it's a weird story of Yuta and Riker, but it is. And she is the chef and the food taster for the prime minister. So in case, someone wants to poison the prime minister, she dies first and then the prime minister won't eat anything, which makes sense.
A lot of discussion of food on this episode. There's a lot of food moving around, things being poured, liquids, replicator instructions. And I thought also, if this is a warp-capable society or a warp-contact society or whatever, they seem to be completely non-impressed by the ship. It's beautiful when they go to warp. That's great. But the replicator, this is where the inconsistent distribution of technology across the Star Trek universe.
Yes.
Which I know you've talked about in previous episodes.
It seems weird that they would not know of replicators.
Yeah. So, and they didn't arrange to bring any food on board, it seems like, either.
No, they just wanted a kitchen. That's all they need. Although they have boxes, so maybe they have boxes full of food,
apron,
I guess.
They're Blue Apron boxes. Exactly. Future Blue Apron.
Just the right amount of whatever that weird vegetable, Parthas, is. And so it was an interesting – because I've often thought about, because I'm a sad, lonely man, about how the recipes get into the replicator, right? Because there are like a million ways to make scrambled eggs. So when you ask the replicator for scrambled eggs, is it just giving you like default scrambled eggs? Do you have to tell it your preferences? Do you want like Gordon Ramsay's recipe? Or how does it know what you want, Glenn? That's what I want to know. And this is when we learn about the Parthas, because Riker, in his charm offensive, says, oh, you're a chef, so what's your specialty? And she's like, well, I'm not really a chef. I just kind of make the food, so I don't have a specialty. And he's like, oh, come on, what's your specialty? And she's like, oh, well, these vegetables. I make these vegetables. And then he was like, Parthas a la Yuta. And she's like, I guess.
I look forward to tasting it, he says to her.
Yeah, he does. That's a little leering. Riker.
Yeah, I also like how he just he seems to have – I think this is a recurring theme, is that you could probably do a supercut of Riker pronouncing food words. Doc, and
yes. Riker is an interesting character, because I feel like – and I've said this before, and it's not my theory at all. It's but out there. So they had Kirk, right? And they thought – I feel like there's a meeting with the writers and when they came up with TNG, and they're like, well, we can't do Kirk again, but let's split Kirk into two. So we'll give all the command and the diplomacy stuff, and that'll be our captain. So we've got Picard, and everything that's left over goes into Riker.
And it's funny. I heard you talking about that on another episode, and I had never thought of it before, and I realized it's true, but Riker is so he has in an era in which we're talking about consent, he doesn't push lines. So he'll come on strong, but he backs off. He doesn't.
That's true.
I was listening to a recent episode in which you're talking about Deep Space Nine and Julian Bashir, not quite the same ability to back off respect someone's agency. But I thought Riker. I mean, he expresses his interest openly, and then when things don't go right, I think Worf is so much more of the id, though, of like Kirk's, let's blow that thing up. Well, I recommend firing right now, Kurt.
That is true. And Riker, though, he's a man of action, too. He wants to beam down. He wants to figure it out. And Picard is like, well, let's hail them. Let's see what's going to happen. Let's not, you know, disintegrate Yuta. Maybe we can talk to her.
Maybe not immediately.
But Riker, he operates by a different set of rules. And I do think so. It's interesting to look at Bashir and Riker, because I don't like Bashir at all, right? Because I think he's kind of creepy. And Riker shares many of the same qualities without the kind of know-it-all-ness that Bashir has. But yet I find Riker to be charming. And I think it's just because some people – and I don't know. I mean, the actors, the characters are the characters. So this isn't anything about the actors. I don't know. But some folks are just charming, and charming people can get away with a lot and not seem creepy.
I think that's. I think Jonathan Frakes is a charming performer, and I think this is a perfectly constructed role for him to do both the man of action and he actually seems genuinely funny. Even when he has given lines that people laugh at that aren't funny, you still sort of laugh because he's got such good humor. And I think that's the actor coming through in a role that's sometimes underwritten. In this episode, he's kind of underwritten, and he still doesn't come across as a creep. He just comes across as somebody who actually is a caring person.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so that's why I say thumbs up to Riker, even when he's immediately moving on Yuta.
a very popular tweet of mine was, I'm a Riker liker, which was just a screenshot of Google image map of a lot of Rikers.
Oh, there's a lot of Riker out there.
There's a lot of Riker likers.
I don't know if Riker is – well, I guess he's one of my favorite characters. I don't give Riker a lot of thought because he's just kind of – a very straightforward character.
That's true.
There's not a lot going on there. Although he has his relationship with his father, and he's always – the interesting thing is he's always right second in command to Picard, and he has this loyalty. And he's been offered countless times to his own ship, but he doesn't want to do it. And so you wonder, is that because he doubts his own abilities or because he's so loyal to Picard? And so I guess there's a little bit there too. That doesn't come up in this episode at all, but
it's the flagship. If you're on, ship number 573, you just don't get as much going on. You're just escorting miners out delivering ore from planet to planet or something.
That's true, but you're still captain of that ship. Whereas you're, is it better to be captain of, ship number 483, or is it better to be second in command of the flagship? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. I also recommend for anybody, I repeat myself, so it's possible the last time I was on the show a few years ago, the supercut of Riker sitting down in chairs. If I'm in a bad mood, I can just watch that. It's sort of the equivalent of watching cats and, videos or something. Mm-hmm. Just watch Riker put his leg over chairs over and over and over and over.
And that's
it's very delightful.
It's something that you never notice because it is not that odd. Right. But when it is pointed out to you, you cannot watch an episode of The Next Generation and not see Riker do this. And it's because Jonathan Frakes apparently has a bad back, so it is more comfortable for him, for whatever reason, to sit in chairs by swinging his leg over them and then kind of plopping into them.
I can understand that.
I don't understand it either. Or maybe he just likes it. I don't know. This is an internet rumor. But it's certainly an interesting way to get yourself into a chair that Riker likes to do. So Riker is there. They find the gatherers very easily in their, hideout because they want to have a confab. So they beam down with, Worf, Data, LaForge, and Riker beam down, and nobody's there. OMG. Everybody's gone. Maybe they're in the wrong place. But there's where this cool lit set. I really liked it. And then, there's the generator. So clearly they're in the right place. And this is when they figure out, it's an ambush. And the gatherers pop up and start shooting at them. It's very exciting, although it isn't really that exciting. And then where there's a little, Riker sets some metal on fire and creates a smoke screen, and they pretend to beam away, but they're really there. And then
I was impressed by the math ability. They knew the temperature that would ignite at, and then they were able to, that's setting 7. I'm like, how could you instantly translate the temperature? Maybe you learned that in Star Trek Academy, 2,400 degrees Celsius is setting 7. Remember that, because when you need to ignite a pile of uranium, you'll need,
it'll come in handy. Trust me.
exactly.
Kind of like, you know, when you're in math class and they're like, you will use this in the real world. Trust me. And everyone rolls their eyes. And this is where we have this, you know, Riker's like, we're not here to fight. We're here to talk. And everyone's like, oh, all right, let's talk. very quickly, once again, everybody is, okay, let's talk. And so they beam down the prime minister and the leader of the gatherers, who's, I guess, the sub-commander of the gatherers, because he's only the leader of this part of the gatherers. The gatherer bureaucracy is very complicated. Is convinced that maybe they can work something out. And while all this is happening, an old dude, old gatherer dude wanders off. And meets Yuta, and Yuta says, oh, you are a member of this clan, and I am the last member of this clan. And the guy's like, oh, that no, there are no members of that clan. And she says, well, I got a secret for you, and touches his face, and he dies.
He was in a particularly cool outfit, actually. I thought he had, like, the most excellent, like, cyberpunko world warrior thing going on.
Yes, and it turns out Yuta, we find out, spoiler alert, is the last surviving member of this clan. And part of the thing that with these aliens is they were clan-based, and the prime minister explains that, you know, they had hundreds of years of war, because basically every clan, if you insulted one clan member or slighted them in any way, it would basically lead to a blood feud that would last forever, which is not really a great way to have a stable civilization. If everyone is fighting everyone all the time.
It is true. We learned that from the Vulcans. We know that.
That's true. Although the Klingons seem to manage, but...
mostly. Yes. I do like there's a bit coming up that the rebel leader, this sub-rebel leader, Brawl. That's a Brawl.
Brawl.
So Brawl agrees to talk, wants to go take it to the other leader. And he's like, well, come back in 20 days. And Picard's like, we got other plans. We're not going to.
Yeah, you guys are not as important as you think you are.
Exactly.
We got other things to do. I hope to be far away from here in 20 days is what he says, which I think is very funny. So yes, that's a glimpse into, so Picard is in his most Picardy in this episode, right? Because he's negotiating a deal between two people. He's a diplomat at heart, but he also is a busy man. And so he's like, I'm not waiting 20 days, people. I'm the flagship.
He's often in the foreground as the main character driving the action. In this case, he's really a very secondary character. If you watch this episode and if someone said, is this like all other Star Trek Next Generation episodes? You said yes. They would think that Picard was like a minor functionary and the whole show revolved around other people.
It's true, because Picard is basically in the background and in moments, in scenes where they basically explain the backstory. And then we've got Riker actually doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Everybody says, okay, let's beam up to the Enterprise because, surprise, I'm not actually the leader of the Gatherers. We have to go somewhere else. And everyone's like, what? Why do we have to go somewhere else? But we do, because he lives on a tiny ship somewhere. So let's go there. It's like the tiny house concept. He lives on a tiny ship.
I like the fact that when the old guy is dead, they find him dead. They're like, he's old. It's fine. Strip his body. You're good. And it was like, wait a minute. But it cracked me up where I'm like, it felt like there was an unresolved aspect here. It's like, someone dies in your midst when your enemies are there, aren't you suspicious? But now they're very trusting. It's okay.
Well, that guy was really old.
That's true.
And you feel like the gatherers perhaps don't give life as much value as perhaps other people do.
Oh, but when Dr. Crusher comes down and says, yes, it was cardiac arrest, then he's been dead too long. I'm like, what were you going to do?
She was going to resurrect him.
Yeah, they don't have Borg science there. I mean, come on.
There were a couple, a few instances, I can't name episodes, where Dr. Crusher has revived someone who's died if she gets to them in time. So I don't know what that time limit is. But apparently it is less than 5 minutes because seemingly that's how long it took her to get there.
It's true.
She says, it was a heart attack. And Riker's like, you don't sound so sure. And she says, well, it was definitely a heart attack. But there's no reason this man should have had a heart attack. So I'm up in the air about it. And they're like, well, let's take the body.
Exactly.
We don't need to ask because they don't care. Yeah. We'll take the body. We'll do some tests. And we'll also take Roll. And we'll take a couple. I think actually he goes by himself to prove that he trusts them, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody beams up to the Enterprise. And they go off to meet the other gatherer because that gatherer couldn't be in the same place as everybody else for whatever reason. And this is where we get some awkward scenes with Brawl walking around kind of like a bull in a china shop. And he, makes fun of Wesley for a while and does that thing where you want to be friends with someone. So you make fun of them and then they turn around and they realize, oh, you're actually kind of a charming rascal. And everybody likes you.
It was, the whole, I felt like, no offense to the actor, but some offense to the actor. he could not really pull off. I saw Sissel sound off off base, but Three Penny Opera, great musical, Bertolt mm-hmm. Brecht, Kurt Weill. And the person who plays Mac the Knife has to be incredibly, intensely, like thinly restrained violence and charm. And I saw a production of it once where the guy was so milquetoast. I'm like, I don't believe you could kill anybody. Mm-hmm. You're just, and I had the reaction. This guy's like, hey, I'm a big man. It's like you, it's just kind of like LA, you know, or Miami Vice kind of feeling as opposed to like, you know, a big heavy, but like, I think it actually could have been a better episode with more, with some better casting in those roles. Mm. But I feel like they didn't really pay much attention. They just wanted people who are sort of burly and could just, you know, run around and have a lot of chest hair.
And the chest hair, I think, was like, take off your, well, you don't have to take off your shirt, just pull down the collar and let's see how much chest hair you have.
Although,
I guess we could have a Merkin, right? And it'll be fine if you don't have enough chest hair. But chest Merkin.
Yes. Oh, yeah. My gosh, yes, absolutely.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a fan of Wesley Crusher all that much, but I did feel bad for Wesley because this guy was kind of a jerk to him.
It's like the guy going to 10 forward and like just taking somebody else's drink, which doesn't matter because the drinks are ostensibly replicated or are they mixed beyond the bar? I don't understand that either.
I think they're just replicated. That was actually my favorite moment with this character where he just walks in and takes that guy's grape juice or whatever it was, exactly. Like grapefruit juice, and just drinks it and walks by. And I was like, that's fantastic. Although then it led me to think about something that I'd never thought about before. But all the talk of cooking and kitchens made me think about it. How do you get assigned to be the bartender in 10 Forward? It seems like that is a job that doesn't require a lot. And if it's not Guinan, it's just some random flunky.
Well, I was wondering if the notion was that it was sort of a because it was a convivial place, that it was a place where you didn't go to get something replicated, that they actually did handwork. It was like an artisanal.
So they're like mixologists back there, you
fashioned,
think?
Yeah, it was like an old-fashioned thing. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm going to go over and get my mustache waxed and have a drink at 10 Forward or something.
That's right. Get my hat steamed or whatever. Visit the Milner and then go to 10 Forward.
It kind of goes in with like the holodeck is like the full-on sensory experience. And 10 Forward, you go there to relax. So, you know, if you could get a drink in your room, but you go there and so they make you a drink. They replicate the bottles of liquor. But, you know, they also talk about they acquire liquor from interesting places. They'll talk about a rare bottle of whatever. And I'm like, well, obviously the replicator – I think there is an issue about the replicator not making alcohol of certain kinds, isn't there?
On ships, they will not make – they'll just do synthahol, right? Because you can't get drunk on a ship. So
maybe that's part of the restriction. So you actually have to bring alcohol on board and it's mixed at a bar if you want anything serious.
If you want and then they ID you so Wesley Crusher can go there. But he can't get drunk.
Exactly. I mean, I've seen bottles of wine that have been in crew quarters. This is a very interesting topic. I've never really thought about alcohol in Star Trek. I bet there's a book.
It's true.
There's probably a book about it.
People are always drinking Romulan ale, which is illegal. So what the heck, man?
Yeah, you'd think the transporter would have a detector. Yeah, that's Romulan ale.
Oh, that's true. And that makes another question, though, right? Because basically, if you have like this fine vintage wine and you can replicate it, one assumes exactly because you could get the molecular structure and all that good stuff. But you go to the trouble of actually getting the bottle and, you know, sourcing it. You go to France or wherever. Do you take a shuttlecraft to the Enterprise? Because if you go through the transporter, isn't that exactly the same as having a replicated bottle
I wonder if there's something like if you can get if it gets corked. Hey, oh, this wine has been replicated. It's all terrible now. Yeah, exactly. I can tell you didn't use the artisanal shuttlecraft delivery of this wine.
So many fascinating things about the ramifications of transporters and replicators. And the reason why we're thinking about these things is because this episode is not that interesting.
I have to go back to the early part where he gets a glass of water. You know, he asks the prime minister, the president of the planet, and she's mm-hmm. like, yeah, like water. And he shows how to use the thing. And I'm like, the fact that it replicates a glass just seems very inefficient to me. I wanted actually to push a glass out and then have it, you know, spew water in like in one of those dispenser machines. That's what I really want to see.
That made me think, again, another thing about the faults. Maybe everybody has like a profile, so it knows if your voice, obviously can recognize your voice. So Riker likes to have that glass, that size glass, because when exactly. I'm drinking water, I have a giant 40-ounce bottle that I have of water, because it makes me drink it all, and you should stay hydrated, folks. That's my tip to you. But the glass that he replicates is like a tiny tumbler full of water.
Well, it's also, if you can replicate the vessel in which it's held, you could replicate anything.
It could have been
like a translucent, a tree-shaped object with a straw out of it. I mean, you could do anything.
Mm-hmm. It's just to impress. And you want to impress her.
Yes.
So have like a fine cut crystal glass or something.
Or a crazy straw.
With a crazy straw. That I demand a crazy straw. It's the 24th century, damn it. I want a crazy straw.
Computer, make Swarovski fine cut crystal with crazy straw. Water, 5 degrees.
5 degrees, yes. And that's the other thing. I would never want to say exactly what degree I want of my water. Although Picard doesn't. He always, you know, tea Earl Grey hot. So he just trusts the replicator to make it hot.
You have to brew tea. You have to steep tea. So if it's hot, what does that mean? Shouldn't it be boiled to a certain temperature or below boiling and then it's steep? Like, wouldn't you say, I don't know, like hot, what does hot mean? What does hot mean in context of tea steeping?
But here's the thing though, right? You do steep tea, but then there is a point at which it's done to your liking and you drink it.
It's
so
true.
I assume you just replicate it at that point and then you just drink it.
There are many unanswered questions.
I need to write a letter. That's what's happening. And get this to the bottom of this. Because that, you know, part of the whole thing, I'm not a tea drinker, but I know like the ceremony and doing all the stuff is part of the meditative process of tea making for some people. Other people, like you, get a tea robot. Or lust after a tea robot. I don't know if you have one or not.
I got a gift of a tea robot. It was unexpected arrival.
It's like the first step to your tea replicator, Glenn.
Oh, it's true. I should also point out that earlier when I quoted Hitchhiker's Guide, I quoted it wrong. It's a substance. Here's the quote. It's a substance almost entirely, but not quite, unlike tea. Because otherwise people are going to write in because that's the most famous quote out of the book. So
it's true. They are people. People are persnickety. They're sticklers. All right. So basically the rest of this episode, they go, they find the ship that the head honcho, it lives on, that is a piece of crap, and he shoots the Enterprise a couple times and nobody cares because it's not going to do any damage, and they disable his shields. They beam over, even though he doesn't want them to, which I thought was interesting.
I love Picard looks really peeved when he's in the middle of talking and they get hit again and he has to do a fake move and he's like, all right, fire.
That's right. Yeah. Bring their shields down. And then he's like, what are you doing here? This is a trap. And Picard's like, we're beaming over. Get ready for it. And they're like, what? And he's like, we're coming over. We're already there. They have some tense moments where they are at loggerheads and then they break into basically.
Oh, we missed the romantic scene, though.
Oh, that's true. We didn't miss
the romantic scene. I was thinking that happened later. It happens earlier.
Yes, and that's important. So Yuta makes Riker the vegetables. She serves it to Riker and Troy. They both taste it. They think it's good. And then Troy, reading the room, says, I got to go wash my hair or something.
She didn't even have to use her empathic sense. She just got up and got out of there.
Yeah, she's like, I got to go. And so Yuta and Riker bond over root vegetables. And then later, Yuta gets the night off. And so the prime minister basically says, why don't you go hang out with Riker? Because I noticed he's been hovering all over you. And so she says,
sweet.
Okay.
I was like, that's very insightful from a planetary leader. And this is like her bonded servant. So I thought that was actually very, you know, kind.
Yeah, and that made me think, well, maybe she's not that bad of a boss. Yeah. She's paying attention. And off Yuta goes. They kiss. I think they kiss, right? But then Riker is like, what's wrong? And she says, well, I don't think I can feel anymore. And Riker's like, well, this is strange. I don't want to take advantage of you. If you're not going to get anything out of this, let's just snuggle.
I know. Again, the consent thing, like he every step, even though she came to his quarters, he was not aggressive. He was paying attention. He backed off. He realized she was hurt. He had the empathy. He's like, you know, he had, I feel your pain. Who did this to you? I want to, you know, and then.
It was very nice.
Yeah, it was all-
And then he hugs her, and it was nice. And then there's a red alert, so he's like, I gotta go. And she stays in his quarters, which I found weird, but whatever.
It's like a blocking problem. It's like, all right, you leave there, and you just stay there. Just stand on your mark.
It'll be fine. And then, yeah, that's when they come upon the ship, and everybody, they beam over. They decide, quickly it boils into bickering over articles of Confederacy, basically.
Exactly. That was a very, very technical series of discussion about the composition of this peace deal. But
it was three seats on the council. Nobody gets three seats on the council. But this, while that's happening, Dr. Crusher figures out a microvirus is the cause of the heart attack. They do some sleuthing with LexisNexis to figure out what's going on, and they find another person who died of the same thing.
I did like that, where they're basically like doing Wikipedia searches, right? And they're just like, they're, what are these tribes? Well, here are all the tribes, and we have the entire database of every person on the planet. Just by the way, they just gave us their whole database of everybody and all of their DNA, but that's cool, right?
It's fine. Yeah, exactly. This is before HIPAA, so it's okay. There's no healthcare prime directive, so it's
give us every piece of health information about everyone who ever lived on your planet. Sure, here you go.
Transmitting right now. And they find out, Yuta, well, part like a quarter of Yuta's face is in this picture.
That's
but
great.
Luckily, the computer can enhance it and reconstruct it, and it's Yuta 53 years ago. She is not what she seems.
Okay, so it's implausible that they could reconstruct the entire face, but not impossible. Like, it wasn't totally ridiculous. And there was something about it which I felt was very futuristic, though, which was the notion that a computer could extrapolate that information, even though, you know, we have technology that can do that. You can use Photoshop today and do these weird, like, smart fills where you drag and it, like, makes up information from the photo that is indistinguishable from the real part. It doesn't reconstruct a face. But so I was like, that was a little bit of like, oh, okay, that's not so bad. I can stop the enhance, zoom, enhance thing, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't bad, and I felt like they showed enough of the face that you could identify it yourself without needing to reconstruct it. So it made it feel more plausible that a computer could then reconstruct it.
They also had the database of every photo ever taken on the planet. Right. Probably.
So that helps. So, yeah, exactly. All the webcams and drones and surveillance cameras on the planet. It's a heavily surveilled society.
It's true.
I assume.
That's based on what we, based on the fact that they have everyone's DNA who ever lived. Yes.
That's true. And then Riker's like, aha. It's Yuta. She's the one that killed this guy, killed this other person in this picture with her microvirus because she's the last of this clan, and these people are of the clan that killed her clan. But, you know, what could be the problem? And that's when we find out, oh no, the leader of the Gatherers is the last of the clan that killed her clan. So clearly she's going to kill him. So this is when we get Action Riker. He appears. He transports over. Everyone's like, what the hell is going on? And I like this part where the Gatherer leader is like, oh, this is an ambush. What's going on? And Captain Picard is like, he's my first officer. He has a very good reason for doing this. And there's a beat. And then he turns and he's like, you do have a good reason for this, right?
There was so much wrong with this scene, though. It's like he could have run over and tackled her. He could have beamed in front of her.
Yes.
He could have stunned her. I mean, Dr. Crusher made it clear that this microvirus would not harm anyone who didn't have exactly the same DNA. She could have spat from where she was standing, actually, now that I think about it. But.
She could have. That's how I thought that it was going to happen. Yeah, I don't understand. So, and this is where we find out that there were five remaining clans, people that survived the attack, and somehow they all gave up their life force and infused it into Yuta or something. So she's like super Yuta. Yeah. And so that made me think, here's my headcanon, that Riker was trying to stun her, but she was, you know, she's beefy with her revitalized cells, so she was immune to stunning. And they do show Riker, you know, turning up his phaser to 11. So I assume that's what happened instead of, but he could have just tackled her. You'd not that big.
My headcanon was the same, was that I was thinking that she was actually like unusually strong, was what we're going to find out. And so he didn't tackle her because he suspected she might not be, he might, I mean, they didn't do any of this. Maybe it's on the cutting room floor, you know, deleted scenes, but most people can't withstand a phaser stun like that. You know, you could, you
right. look, he does it a couple times too. So
yeah.
And she doesn't stop. She keeps going. She wants to get in like the slowest. She totally could have gotten to that guy, just like lunging at him. But she doesn't.
He vaporizes her. It's pretty sad. I actually found that. I found the whole thing. I thought the episode was did not have a lot of emotional valence. Or a few points, like when she's in his cabin, and I felt there was a bit there where I was like they kind of touched into something. They tapped into something that felt more genuine. And at this point, when she's like struggling about her duty and what she's been doing for 100 years or 80 years or something, and then she can't turn away from it. I thought that was actually a little sad. And Riker kind of turning away and feeling the impact of there's a lot of shows in which somebody kills somebody with a special ray or something, and they're just like, okay, we're done. It's like, no, you killed another light. You killed somebody. Nobody, even in the future, is going to walk away from that. And I felt like he had at least some reaction of not just I cared about this person, but I took a life.
Yes, and there was and the end scene I really like, which is he's sitting in 10-4, drinking his artisanal martini or whatever it is he's drinking, and Captain Picard, who is not the warmest person in the world, and that's why we have a Riker. Right, Riker's job is to liaison with the crew and make sure everybody's happy and translate the captain's orders to the crew. That's basically what Riker does. And so, you know, Picard is there and he's like, well, hey, Riker, our mission is canceled. So we've got to stop over at a starbase, to pick up some supplies. And Riker's like, oh, that sounds exciting. And Picard's like, yeah, I was thinking we don't need the whole crew. So I'm going to, whoever wants, shore leave, Riker, can stay at the starbase and perhaps recuperate from traumatic experiences. I don't know. I gotta go. And then he leaves.
Although I was wondering if the setup was going to be that Troy comes in and sits there and just even quietly empathizes with him without even saying anything, just looks at him and orders a drink and something like that. But this was interesting because Picard was so like, you know, wooden this whole episode for him to come in, but it still felt it felt in character for him to do something like that, like to not try to be all touchy-feely with him, but to give him an out to make sure he knew that the captain was on his side and that if he needed the time, he could take it. But it was more military at some level. Like it felt more like something military people might do as opposed to the like outright emotion thing that we often get in the show.
Right. And I think that is it's in keeping with Picard, right? Because Picard is the type of character who, when he's confronted with something like this, his way of grieving or getting over a problem is throwing himself into work, right? So he doesn't want to take that option away from Riker, but he's also self-aware enough to know that not everyone reacts the same way. So he wants to give Riker the option of choosing another course to deal with this.
That's very good. Sensitive leader who may not be touchy-feely, but understands the needs of his crew.
Exactly. Yes. And so that, Glenn, is the episode, The Vengeance. I've forgotten even the name of it. The Vengeance Factor.
I learned with this episode that I don't remember how to spell vengeance. I misspelled it so many times. I can't
it's
even
not an
you.
Easy word. That that word has too many vowels in it.
It does.
Let's just vowels. Be honest. So what did you think of this episode?
Well, you know, as we were talking about the outset, it's kind of thin. Like, I don't expect Star Trek Next Generation to have 15 plots, but I do expect there to be a little bit of an interleave story and often a payoff. And usually there can be a main, like, big plot story that's kind of geopolitical. And then a smaller story is often very personal. And then sometimes they intersect in an interesting way, or maybe they don't. But that there's, you get into, and in this case, the big plot was, you know, so intertwined following Riker practically solo through it that I think it did miss something because of that. On the other hand, I felt like it showed him to very good advantage, the actor, and it was nice to have something where Yuta's interest in him was not part of the plan. She wasn't trying to use him. And I thought when she went to his quarters, I figured she was going to try to get something from him that would let her accomplish whatever mission she had. And instead, she was just seeking out, looking for, you know, some kind of sense of life that wasn't this duty that she'd faced her whole existence.
Yeah.
And that worked for me. So not a great episode, but it was not deeply flawed. It actually made sense. At one point, I was thinking, isn't her plot unnecessarily complicated that she would manage to go to this place? And I'm like, oh, no. The whole point is she's in the office. So whenever they arrest any of these people, which they inevitably will because they're always pursuing them, either she'll find out all her enemies are dead through the office of the prime minister, or she'll have the ability to kill them directly as she did before. But at first I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, oh, no. She just wants to be in position to know. Either she can execute them or she knows they've been killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think Yuta is obviously a tragic figure, so I think that was kind of well done. But overall, kind of a mediocre episode.
Yeah, but
Riker, he's so charming that that helps.
That's right. Well, this is very enjoyable. In some of the episodes you've had recently, I've heard people in extreme pain. The pain machine, pain sticks from the episode they listed. This was very good.
Mm-hmm.
I was perfectly satisfied with the random generator.
And I am perfectly satisfied with your guest appearance, Glenn.
Thank
so thank
you. Very
you.
Much. I feel
thank
very
you
adequate
for joining.
Right now.
You are adequate is the perfect description.
Thank you. Achieved the competence level that I desired.
That's right. Thanks so much, Glenn, for joining me.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on again.